Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 85. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're going a little bit retro. First off, I'm going to take a look at a 1995 American action film, Congo, starring Laura Linney, Tim Curry, and a bunch of fake apes. Then we go back to 1976 for Logan's Run, starring Michael York and Jenny Agutter. So we've got killer apes, we've got killer robots, we've got Peter Ustinov, and we've got a shopping mall future. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we will start the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Shit, I forgot my espresso. I was so busy setting up for the podcast, my espresso went cold. That's just not good enough. Hi, everybody. How you doing? Things are cooling off here as the world turns and Australia goes toward the wintry season, which is not to my liking, but it's inevitable and not much I can do about it unless somebody wants to finance me having a summer house somewhere tropical or a winter house somewhere tropical. Not likely to happen, but the fantasy does keep me warm on many a long, cold winter night. So, I've drawn the annual Patreon subscriber box full of wonderfulness that I gather each year for the Patreon subscribers, and that I will pass on to the Patreon subscriber who wins. And this time around, it is Julia Hilton. So Julia is going to be delivered of a box full of movies and movie-related stuff. And another one will roll around the 17th of April next year, which is my birthday. It's about sharing the love of my birthday and not being a totally selfish prick, even though I am inclined toward that. So congratulations, Julia. I will arrange to get you the box. I'll probably deliver it myself. I think you've got a birthday coming up, so it's a big win there anyway. So there you go. Next time around, it might be somebody overseas, which I'm hoping it will, just for a bit of a change. And if it is, of course, the postage gets a little bit expensive, but I will wear it anyway. So again, thank you to the Patreon subscribers, and thank you to people who just listen too. I mean, not everybody's into crowdfunding things, and that's perfectly fine. There's no coercion here. And I do get some great feedback from various people, including Dale Rontree, who just had a birthday and sent that he loved the last Martian Drive-In podcast. So happy birthday on the air, Dale, and I'm glad that you enjoy the show. So what have I been watching? I really should get the letterboxed up and take a look at what I've been watching. I haven't watched a lot of movies, and I've just looked at the letterbox, and there's only really one. I did see a movie called Selfless from 2015, which stars Ryan Reynolds and Ben Kingsley. It's about a kind of rich billionaire bastard played by Ben Kingsley who's dying of cancer and just gets an opportunity to put his mind into a younger body, which, of course, is the Ryan Reynolds bit. It gives itself away pretty quickly on the twist in the plot, and there's the usual action sequences. There's actually quite a good action sequence on a country farm, which is to be admired. I like the way they dealt with it, and I like the way they used the environment to kind of inform the action. So, you know, they're in a country house. What do you have in a country house? They look around a country house, and they find ways to make the action work for that context, which is not a which can be a difficult skill. And if you're just kind of ticking the boxes in a movie, you really don't go to that depth. But this one had that. I picked it pretty early, and it's fairly obvious exactly what's happening in the movie, which is a little bit of a problem. Reynolds is good, a very professional actor. Of course, he's in Deadpool, and everybody loves him in that. But he kind of has that everyman looking at everyman style that works in this kind of an action film. Ben Kingsley gets top billing almost, and he's only in the movie for the first 15 minutes. It's got some other people in it, Victor Garber and a few others. But it's not one of those big budget action films. It's just kind of a good, honest little science fiction twisty action film, which has a little bit, but not too much to say about the current culture wars that are going on. But nonetheless, it's if you want to check it out, check it out. It's neither recommended nor not recommended, if you know what I mean. So anyway, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, I'm going to be looking at Congo, first 1995 movie, directed by Frank Marshall, starring Dylan Walsh, Tim Curry, Delroy Lindo's in it, Laura Linney, and a bunch of very unhappy apes.
Each morning a missionary advertised with neon sign. He tell the native population that civilization is fine. And three educated savages holler from a bamboo tree. That civilization is a thing for me to see.
So bongo, 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 I don't wanna leave the Congo. Oh no, 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 no. Bingo, bango, bongle, I'm so happy in the jungle I refuse to go. Don't want no bright lights, false teeth, doorbells, landlords, I make it clear
that no matter how they coax him,
I'll stay right here. I look through a magazine the missionary's wife concealed.
Magazine? What happens?
I see how people who are civilized bung you with automobiles.
You know you can get hurt that way, Daniel?
At the movies they have got to pay many coconuts to see.
What do they see, Donnie?
Uncivilized pictures that the newsreel takes of me.
So, bongo, 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 he don't wanna leave the Congo. No, 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 no. Bingo, bango, bongo, he's so happy in the jungle he refused to go.
Don't want no penthouse, bathtub, streetcars, taxis, noise in my ear.
So no matter how they coax him,
I'll stay right here.
They hurry like savages to get aboard an iron train.
The Tringalingo Hula Humble Express.
And though it's smoky and it's crowded, they're too civilized to complain.
Alokatohosahimahena,
when they've got 2 weeks vacation, they hurry to vacation ground.
What do they do, Donnie?
They swim and they fish, but that's what I do all year round.
So, bongo, 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 I don't wanna leave the Congo, no, 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 no. Bingo, bango, bongo, I'm so happy in the jungle I refuse to go.
Don't want no jailhouse,
shotgun,
fish hooks,
golf club,
I got my spears.
So no matter how they coax him,
I'll stay right here.
They have things like the autumn bomb,
so I think I'll stay where I am.
Civilization, I'll stay right here.
That was Danny Kaye and the Andrews Sisters with Civilization, a song which is both culturally insensitive and borderline racist. Nonetheless, it's part of history of music, and as Kay Kaiser once called it, the College of Musical Knowledge. So, and it's the only song I know that's got Congo in it. So Congo, we've got a 1995 American action-adventure film with a slightly science fiction premise, which I'm not going to give away because I think it's kind of cool, and I'll leave it for people to discover if they haven't already seen the movie, which is 21 years old now. The plot's fairly simple, and it's an old jungle adventure movie updated. So it's a Jungle Jim kind of movie, King Solomon's Mines kind of movie, and that gets referenced in the film. It's the kind of role, as Roger Ebert said in his review, that Stuart Granger or... it's the kind of movie that Stuart Granger or Clark Gable would have played in had it been made in the 1940s or the 1950s. The story's fairly simple, and the whole idea is to get people into the jungle and into danger as quickly as possible. IMDb says, a megalomaniac CEO sends his son into the dangerous African Congo on a quest for a source of diamonds large enough and pure enough to function as powerful laser communication transmitters. When contact is lost with his son and the team, his daughter-in-law is sent after them. She's an ex-daughter-in-law. She was married to Charles, the character who gets lost, played oddly enough by Bruce Campbell. And she's played by Laura Linney. Her name's Karen. She's a former CIA operative and accompanied by G-Wiz gadgetry and a few eccentric characters, including a mercenary, a researcher with a talking gorilla, and a nutty Indiana... This is a shit premise. Basically, here's what happens. A primatologist has taught a female gorilla called Amy to talk. He's played by Dylan Walsh. He teaches her to talk and has a computerized glove for her so that her hand gesture talking, which indeed some gorillas are taught to do, is translated into words. So he's taking her back to her gorilla tribe because she doesn't seem to be blending in very well in the laboratory environment where they have her. So with the aid of Hermika Homolka, a very shady character played by Tim Curry, who's Romanian, and as Ebert says, is playing the Peter Lorre role, they arrange for an expedition to go to the jungle and to put Amy back with a gorilla tribe. Now, meanwhile, Travicom, the company owned by megalomaniac CEO Joe Don Baker, has lost Bruce Campbell and the expedition when they're off looking for these diamonds. So they send Laura Linney, his former daughter-in-law, to head the expedition, aided along the way by Joe Pantoliano, as a local liaison, to basically go and find the diamonds and find out what happened to Charles, the son, played by Bruce Campbell. Now, I'm going to play the trailer now, and then I'm going to talk about the movie. Sorry, that was all fucked up there, but I'll get back on track in a moment.
Activate the remote.
In the race for the world's most advanced communications technology, a shocking discovery has been made.
What was that?
Lock your remote. Give me a thermal reading. Resolve to 6-6.
It will take two young scientists into the heart of the African jungle, where a secret hidden for 2,000 years holds the key to the future.
This is Karen Ross, 81452, Houston, do you read?
You used to work for the CIA, and now you're Travicom.
Some will come to it for science.
This is a big deal, Charles. This is a big find.
Some for fortune.
A diamond mine of incredible bounty.
And some to return home.
She doesn't really belong anywhere, does she?
No, she belongs here.
Together, they will search.
My boss, he thought I wasn't going to make it. He sent another expedition.
Drawn deep into a mystery.
Camp destroyed. People dead. A gray gorilla.
No such thing as a gray gorilla.
I saw one.
And the more they discover...
Same hieroglyphics over and over.
The greater the danger.
What do they say?
We are watching you.
Help me!
I never saw any animal move like that.
Shoot it! Shoot it! How intelligent are they?
I'd say they're smart. They're too damn smart. Watch out!
Go! We're getting out of here.
What about them?
Put them on the endangered species list.
From the best-selling novel by the author of Jurassic Park.
The myth of the killer ape is true.
Oh, Congo, where you are the endangered species.
See, that trailer takes exactly the wrong tone, so this should be a lot lighter because it's an action-adventure film. You've got to play up the comedy, and yes, there is horror, and there's some good suspense in it as well. But the trailer kind of makes you think it's a horror movie, and it definitely is not that. In a sense, it's an homage to a lost genre of cinema, of action-adventure cinema. And in recognizing that, they really did need to kind of, have a lighter touch. So to continue the plot, they head off into the jungle and have encounters with many things. A tribe of ghost people who paint themselves white for reasons best known to themselves. They have an encounter with hippopotami in the river when they're traveling down the river in rafts. They also then reach the lost city of Zinj and find a group of gorillas who are related to Amy. And in doing so, they also find the diamonds and find what happened to the previous expedition. And I'm going to do the spoilers because the trailer's kind of done the spoilers. They find a group of killer apes, killer gorillas in a sense, that have been bred since pre-Christian times by the people who were running the Lost City of Zinj to guard the diamonds. They're basically set up, they were domesticated and set up as guard dogs for this immense treasure of alluvial diamonds that's in the city. And they then turned on the people who trained them, and rightly so, I suppose. But still, 2,500 years later, are guarding the diamonds and guarding the city. And they're not only incredibly vicious and feral and probably carnivorous, but they're also very intelligent and very tactically smart, which makes a really, really cool part of the movie. Once the grey gorillas start attacking, things start getting very interesting. The cast is kind of interesting in its own way too. Laura Linney plays Karen Ross. Now, Laura Linney is an actor that I really had trouble warming to and enjoying her work, because the first thing I saw her in was The Truman Show, where she played a character that I really didn't like. She played the kind of fake wife to Truman Burbank, played by Jim Carrey in that movie. And there were the way she played it really kind of made me think, I don't like this woman, I don't like her character, I don't like her acting. But I've seen her in other things since, including Mr. Holmes, which I think she does a tremendous job in. And I've kind of warmed to her over time, and I like what she does, and I like the way that she kind of does her craft. So I'm very kind of, I've moved on from that initial opinion of Laura Linney's work. Then we got Dylan Walsh playing Dr. Peter Elliott, the guy who trained Amy the gorilla. I'll come back to him in a moment. Then we've got Ernie Hudson playing Captain Munro Kelly, who is the guide that takes them to the lost city of Zinj. And I've got some really nice little audio here to show you how cool and how good Ernie Hudson is in this role. In this clip, he's actually talking with Dylan Walsh's character, Peter Elliott, and they've only just met after the expedition gets off the aeroplane in Africa.
Karen Ross.
That's me.
Munro Kelly. I'm your great white hunter for this trip, though I happen to be black.
How bad is this news for us?
Well, whenever the leadership of one of these little Central African countries comes into question, they tend to just murder everybody.
Oh, my God.
Not really. They live for the opportunity to settle scores, and they've got a lot of scores to settle. It's like what's going on in the Congo. Things are pretty bad in the Congo right now.
We heard.
Is the Kaigani are pissed off. Can't blame them. 20th century sucks. Maybe the 21st will be better.
You're some kind of criminal, aren't you?
Aren't we all?
No, I'm not a criminal. I'm a scientist.
Scientist? I run a few guns. You sons of bitches ruined the world.
Ernie Hudson has exactly the right tone for this movie. It's slightly tongue-in-cheek. He's playing a slightly larger than life. And he's charismatic as all fuck. And I like that. And there's another character actor in this film who does the same thing. And that is Delroy Lindo playing the leader of a militia whom they bribe to get through the territory and to get into Zaire to get out of Zaire to continue on to where the Lost City is. And Delroy Lindo is fantastic in this. One of the things about Delroy Lindo that I like, and that not a lot of people know, is in spite of the fact he's played American characters in a lot of movies, he's actually born and raised in London. He's an Englishman of Jamaican parentage, and apparently he's going to be doing a biopic soon. Where he plays Marcus Garvey. Now, I like Delroy Lindo in any number of things. He's in one of my favourite vulgar pleasure science fiction movies, The Core, where he plays Brasselton. And he's also done things like he was really great playing an angel in Life Less Ordinary in 1997, a movie which wasn't very good apart from a few moments of goodness. So I like Delroy Lindo a lot, and he and Ernie Hudson have exactly the right tone for it. They're kind of light and they're having fun. Then you've got Tim Curry, of course, playing Homolka with a kind of thick and variable Romanian accent. And it's not one of Tim Curry's more nuanced roles. It's kind of broad, and we know he's a bad guy. Everybody in the bloody movie knows he's a bad guy in a sense, because he's slimy and disreputable, and he's spent his life searching for the lost city so he can get hold of the diamonds. But there's something about the character that's not very warm. I don't know whether it's underwritten or what, but I think that Tim Curry could have given it more in some ways. Now there are other people in the cast that are kind of good. Of course, you've got Joe Pantoliano in there, Joey Pants. And he's playing a character called Eddie Ventro, which is odd because he's uncredited in this, as is Delroy Lindo playing Captain Wanter, which is kind of a little bit odd there. I think that they both did a very good job and deserve some kind of credit in the film. You got John Hawkes in there in a brief role playing the sole survivor of the previous expedition who doesn't survive very long. I think this movie may have had some cuts in it as well, because there are characters in it played by character actors like Stuart Pankin and Caroline Seymour who appear in one scene and don't appear in anything else. So I think there may have been some cuts in the pre-African scenes of the film to enable the action to move on to where it needs to be a lot earlier. I think there may well have been script or production problems for this one in some ways. As I said, it was based on a novel by Michael Crichton, and this movie came kind of fairly hard on the heels of the enormous success of Jurassic Park. So Crichton properties were being picked up and turned into productions very quickly. Now, Frank Marshall, the guy who directed a few things, but he's mostly known for his being a producer rather than a director. He's produced along with Spielberg and people like that. The things he directed were Arachnophobia, which is not too bad, Congo, and a movie called Eight Below, and another one called Alive. But as a producer, here's the shit that he did as a producer. You know, just kind of like things like all three Raiders of the Lost Ark movies, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Back to the Future 3, and Part 2 as well, Arachnophobia, Cape Fear, Hook, The Sixth Sense, Snow Falls on Cedars, The Bourne Identity, The Bourne Supremacy, The Bourne Ultimatum, the fifth Indiana Jones movie, Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Ponyo, The Bourne Legacy, and Jurassic World, and the upcoming Assassin's Creed, Jason Bourne and Sully movies. So he's more known as a producer, and even though he's a kind of journeyman director, and there are bits in this film where it really would have been enhanced by having maybe a more experienced director and somebody who can do the action a lot better. There's some bits that, from my knowledge of things, where the action isn't very well kind of blocked out, because the people are running in one direction in one bit and are running in another direction in another. There's not that flow between scenes, particularly when, and this is another trope from the African jungle movies, when the volcano blows up and starts destroying the city, and you've got to have a volcano blowing up and destroying the city in this kind of film. The action sequences where the people are running away from the lava and running away from the enormous cracks in the earth and finding ways across kind of canyons full of lava and all that kind of stuff, the action doesn't flow in one direction very well. And that's a bit of a shame, and it's something that could have been done, but I'm not sure whether there were time constraints. I don't believe there were money constraints, because it had a fairly big budget, but there may well have been time constraints to do that. But it's a little bit of a shame, because it would have been nice to have just that little TLC given to the action sequences. Now, Having said that, there is, as I said, there's a weakness in the cast, and the weakness in the cast is this. Dylan Walsh is pretty much a charisma-free zone. He went on to do television, things like Nip Tuck. He was in that. But in this one, his character, and as you heard in that little clip with Ernie Hudson, I'm a scientist, I'm not a criminal. He's kind of like a stick-up-his-ass kind of character. It's written that way a little bit, but I think in the hands of another actor, there could have been a bit more charisma given to the character. He doesn't come across as likable. Yes, he's got the cute relationship with Amy the gorilla, and he's very defensive about it, but he's kind of pissed off at every other character in the piece in various times, apart from his sidekick, played by another character actor I like, Grant Heslov, playing Richard, who's the kind of comic relief sidekick to Dr. Peter Elliott. And then you need that in this kind of film. Everybody's got a role. Laura Linney is the tough scientist, kick-ass female. Dylan Walsh is the nerdy scientist. Ernie Hudson's the great white hunter who's black. Tim Curry is Peter Lorre. Grant Heslov is the comic relief guy. The big bad is R.B. Travis, played by Joe Don Baker. Everybody's got their kind of little niche in these kind of films. But Grant Heslov had a greater career after this film as a producer. He's a producing partner to George Clooney, which is not a bad gig to have if you're a kind of character actor. But he's been given a lot of respect for his skills as a producer rather than a director. And he's got a lot of credits as an actor, but his credits as a producer are Monuments Men, let's see, The Ides of March, Memphis Beat, The American, Man Instead of Goats, Good Night and Good Luck, Leatherheads, Intolerable Cruelty. And he's done a little bit of directing too. He directed Men Who Stare at Goats and some pretty much short films and TV stuff. But Grant Heslov, he's got that kind of nerdy look about him. And I think the producing part works for him better, I suppose, than the acting part. But in this one, he's okay and has a fate that the character doesn't deserve, which is always something these kind of films end up doing. But we kind of don't want them to, because his character's likable and he gets a few good lines in there. Not as good as they should be. The script was by John Patrick Shanley, who was better known as a playwright than as a screenwriter, even though he did a few things like film The Moonstruck and The January Man, Joe Versus the Volcano, Congo, of course, and Doubt in 2008, which was based on his play, which is that one about Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, and Meryl Streep about the Catholic priest and did he or didn't he molest a kid, that kind of thing. But I don't think Shanley shines in witty dialogue. I mean, he's no Preston Sturges when it comes to that kind of thing. And I think that Dylan Walsh being miscast in this film is a big mistake. Apparently, and this is what I hear, Bruce Campbell read for the role of Peter Elliott, the scientist. And I think he would have done a great job in it. Bruce Campbell's in the movie for like 5 minutes, and most of that he's seen on a computer screen. Though he does get one of those great scenes that they have in these kind of action films where he turns to the camera and screams as he sees something that we can't see off screen. And he dies. I'm not going to kind of do a spoiler alert on that. Bruce Campbell's character Charles dies in the film right at the start, which is kind of a shame. But because Bruce Campbell's an actor that we all know and love. And he's also written a really nice autobiography, called If Chins Could Talk. But I like this movie. It's one of those films that, here's what works about it. I'll do what it works and what doesn't work in it. Here's what works about it. First off, it refers to an old genre that I like. Jungle adventure films are kind of cool. They're politically incorrect by their nature. They're kind of culturally insensitive by their nature in some ways. So this movie does less of that than they had in the movies that came out in earlier decades. But it's got some really nice location shooting. Some of it was done in Puerto Rico, but a lot of it was done in Africa as well. So you've got that kind of texture and feel of the African jungle. You've got some great makeup effects for the apes and for Amy the ape. by Stan Winston and his people. There's some great animatronic makeup there. And within the limitations of that kind of physical makeup, these days you do it mocap with Andy Serkis. But in 1995, they had to use costumes and talented body actors in a sense. And the character of Amy, we've got to give credit to the actor who played her in this. Her name's Lola No. And she played Amy in this room. She also played a baboon in a TV movie with Ron Perlman called Primal Force, which I remember really fondly because it's got a whole bunch of intelligent apes on an island off the coast of Mexico. And I'm going to have to revisit that movie as well. But her kind of physical acting in this is very good, and under some difficult circumstances, because she would have had to wear a mask with a whole bunch of wires and servos in it in order to play the character. And I think she put, the fact that between her and Stan Winston, they create a character that kind of works in the context of the film is kind of cool. So we've got that working for it. I like the sets for The Lost City. They're quite good as well, even though it's fairly obvious that they're studio-bound sets. They do have a certain wonderfulness about them, and while these days they would have expanded those sets using CG and a number of other things, there are some nice matte painting bits in this film that kind of give us the sense of the lost civilization of Zinj, and the set design where there are a whole bunch of hieroglyphics and a whole bunch of pictograms on the walls that tell the story of how the city came about and how the apes came to be there is kind of cool. There's some nice technology in the film as well. There are some cameras that can be remotely operated from America when they're in Africa, which starts off the film. There's a kind of souped up laser beam, which is never a bad thing. So there's a bit of high tech in there as well. But the centerpiece of the film, and the bit that really works, is the encounter between the expedition and Ernie Hudson and a couple of his men and the apes. So where, basically these apes are coming in and out of various parts of the chamber that they find themselves in, where all the diamonds are. And they kind of attack, and some of them get shot, some of them don't. Some of them then, grab the weapons off the people and throw the weapons to the ground. That bit kind of works really well. There's a nice action sequence in there where we get a full sense of how dangerous and deadly and nasty these apes are, and how they've been trained many, many years ago to basically guard and protect this treasure, for which they have absolutely no use themselves. And that's kind of cool. I haven't read the original novel, but I think I might, even though Crichton's not particularly gifted as a writer, this is one that's kind of piqued my interest in this. One that I may well dip into. I have got an ebook copy of it, so I'm going to dip into that and take a look at it at some stage. But the things that don't work, I think that there are a couple of people miscast, particularly Dylan Walsh. I don't think he has what it takes to carry this kind of a film, and there are parts of the film where he has to do the heavy lifting, and it really, he's got an annoying voice as well, which kind of doesn't help it. But I don't think he was right for the role. Let's put it that way. Let's be kind with this and say he wasn't right for the role. He's kind of persona in acting is not suited for the character particularly. And there are other actors that we like, Delroy Lindo, Jared Pantoliano. We want to see more of them, and also Bruce Campbell, of course. We want to see more of them in the film. We want to kind of enjoy what they bring to a film, and we only get a little bit of them, unfortunately, which is a bit of a shame. But nonetheless, this is kind of one of those films where physical effects came on the verge of that changeover to computer effects, and it's probably can be seen as one of the last hurrah for those physical ape effects before we got into mocap. So it shows the state of the art at the time when our ability to computer generate and to change the physiology of human beings to make them into non-human characters came into play. So this is kind of the last hurrah for physical effects in apes. And we can kind of respect and like the film for that. It's a good old-fashioned adventure film, and there's room for that, I think. Even though more and more The studios are concentrating on big tempo movies, particularly when it comes to these kind of action things and stuff that goes viral. I think that there's a place, particularly in my heart, for this kind of not necessarily A-budget, A-star action films that maybe refer to an older genre, but nonetheless bring something new to it. And the apes in this are probably the most valued players in the movie. They are spectacularly good, and the actors playing in the ape costumes do it extremely well, and the Stan Winston animatronics that make the apes work really is the state of the art. This is top of the top, right up to the point where we suddenly moved over into CG effects. But that's about all I want to say about Congo. It's a movie I like, that while still having a few qualms about it. And there are times, particularly on a weekend afternoon when you haven't got anything else going, when you want a good old-fashioned Saturday matinee action film. And this definitely hits that sweet spot. So I'm going to take a break now, and then we're going to go back to 1976 to have a 1976 look at the 23rd century with Michael Anderson's MGM movie, Logan's Run. Oh, yeah, there's one thing, more thing I want to say about Congo, too. I find it kind of amusing that African porters know all the lyrics to California Dreamin' and will sing it along while they're travelling along on an African expedition. But anyway, I'll take that break now, and then when we get back, it's going to be Logan's Run.
Just imagine a world where you will hold your entire future in the palm of your hand, when a tiny glowing crystal will guide you through an existence in which each day is more wonderful than the last, where it will be possible for you to obtain the fulfillment of every fantasy, the satisfaction of every vanity, the absolute attainment of every wish.
Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents the Saul David production of Logan's Run. A fantastic journey through a world beyond imagination. Welcome to the 23rd century. The perfect world of total pleasure. Imagine a world in which you need never be alone. You touch a switch, turn a dial, and the perfect lover steps into your arms. Every pleasure is yours to experience.
Runner!
There's just one catch.
When the tiny crystal in the palm of your hand flashes its final message, your time is up. Michael York is Logan.
Run, Logan!
Policeman in a perfect world.
No!
Trained to track down runners.
Run, Logan!
Until he is forced to run himself.
Oh, no!
He's a runner!
Logan!
I'm your friend, I understand. We all go crazy once in a while. But she's a runner, and it's over.
Overwhelming, am I not?
Box, an incredible being. More than human, more than machine. Diabolical guardian of the gateway to freedom. For Logan and the woman who loves him.
Seen a face like that before. That must be the look of being old.
MGM takes you into a new age of adventure in the first motion picture of the 23rd century. Logan's Run. It begins where imagination ends.
Logan's Run's a 1976 MGM science fiction movie based on a 1967 novel by William F. Nolan and George Clayton Johnson, where in the novel, I probably should explain the plot first before I get into that. Basically, there's a utopian city. It's the last city on Earth. Everything else has gone to shit because of pollution. And in the city, everybody's young and beautiful. They have an idyllic life. They live their lives, and nobody seems to work apart from one group of people, which is the Sandmen. Well, yeah, there are a couple of other people that work, but there doesn't seem to be a great emphasis on work. The Sandmen are there because everybody has to go to Carousel when they turn 30, meaning that they basically get killed by a computer in a great big kind of aerial performance and a big festival. And on your birthday, when you're the life clock in your hand, which is a little red gemstone, starts blinking, you have to go to Carousel. You put in a red and white leotard. You're made to wear a hockey mask and a hoodie. And you rise up into the air and get destroyed by laser beams or something silly like that. Because nobody's allowed to live after the age of 30. Now, I don't understand the rationale for this, whether in the novel or in the movie. Maybe it's because people under the age of 30 are pig ignorant and it's easier for the computers to keep control of them, which is not how human beings work, really. But in the novel, it's actually 21 when the people are killed. But they're done slightly differently. Basically, the only thing common between the movie and the novel is a couple of the characters and the basic premise of a dystopian society where people are killed at an early age. Now, the movie was originally going to be made in 1969. George Pal wanted to produce it. He was actually producing things for MGM at the time, and he wanted to produce it. Now, we're going to make it with Robert Redford in 1969, but that didn't happen. Now, there were other actors who were going to be cast in the roles. They're quite an interesting choice. The character of Logan was originally going to be played by none other than John Voight. The character of Jessica, played by Jenny Agutter in the movie, was going to be played by Lindsay Wagner. And the Peter Ustinov character in the movie, the old man, was offered to James Cagney at the time. And the character of Francis, played by Richard Jordan in this movie, was originally going to be William Devane. Now, William Devane pulled out of the movie because he got this offer to replace Roy Thinners in another movie, which was Family Plot, one of Hitchcock's last films, if not the last film that Hitchcock did. So you got a choice of doing a science fiction action film, or you got a choice of doing an Alfred Hitchcock movie. I think William Devane made the right choice, and then Richard Jordan went on to play Francis in the movie. And he is very good. Good, solid character actor, Richard Jordan. Died at the age of 56 of brain cancer, which is a shame. But in this one, he's kind of lively and nasty. This is another movie, like Congo, where the lead characters are perhaps in some ways the least interesting of the characters. Basically what happens is Logan's a Sandman. He's one of the people who hunts down people who don't want to die at the age of 30. He, along with his friend Francis, are Sandman. They're kind of a police force come hit squad for the master computer that runs this enormous domed city they live in. Now, the thing for me that's interesting, I'll talk about that in a moment. I'm getting ahead of myself. So basically what happens is the computer decides that it's going to end Logan's life clock early so that he appears to be a runner, so that he can trace the people who go missing to a place called Sanctuary, where they apparently go to after they escape from the city. Doesn't turn out that that's the case, but that's the theory. So Logan enlists the aid of Jessica, a woman he meets, who wears an anchor around her neck, which is a kind of symbol of life and a symbol of the people who don't believe the Carousel lets people be reborn into new bodies as babies, and believe that, rightly so in fact, that Carousel is just a kind of state-sanctioned way of murdering people. So they run out of the city, they escape from the city, they encounter what really happens to all of the people who escape from the city, the runners that get away. And they encounter a robot called Box, played by Roscoe Lee Brown. Now, Roscoe Lee Brown's character is one of the more interesting ones in there. So basically, they escape from the city, they escape from Box, and they go out into the wilderness and eventually reach Washington, D.C., where in the Library of Congress they meet an old man living with a whole bunch of cats who seems to be the last surviving person outside of the dome. They then return to the dome to tell people what they found, and the movie ends in a really fucked up kind of way. Now, this was one of the last science fiction movies made by a major studio before Star Wars came in and turned everything into a pure child-friendly space opera. This movie does have some adult material in it. And to talk about that, I've probably got to talk about the things that annoyed me about the film. Now, I love the enormous set that they have for the city. There's a kind of miniature set with rail cars running through it and enormous buildings and things like that. It's pretty obvious when you look at it on the Blu-ray version that it is a model, but it's a pretty cool-looking model, and you kind of accept that at the level it is. But the things that annoy me about the movie is this is a civilization that has anti-gravity. It has teleportation. It has, you know, really, really powerful computers. It has the ability to sculpt people's faces and looks in a day, as a day procedure in a hospital kind of clinic. But none of this matters. I mean, one of the interesting things that towards the start of the film is we see the 23rd century equivalent of Tinder, where basically people are put in the circuit, so they appear in a little alcove in your room, and if you want to fuck them, you fuck them. So basically, Logan's feeling a bit kind of anxious and opens the circuit. At first, a man appears, and one of the nice things about this film is that it doesn't seem to have any prejudice against straight or gay people. Logan, in fact, very matter-of-factly asks Jessica when he meets her whether she prefers women or not, and it's not considered anything out of the ordinary, which is to the movie's credit. But what happens is the person appears, teleports into this little alcove in your room, and if you don't want to sleep with that person, you just kind of flick them to the next part of the circuit, and another person appears. So they've got teleportation in this civilization, and all they use it for is a 23rd century version of Tinder, or Grindr, depending on, of course, your gender preference. That seems a total waste of it. And then they've got these rail cars to go between buildings in this enormous domed city with the parklands in between the buildings. Why would you have the rail cars to go between A and B when you can actually teleport people between A and B? The technology doesn't make sense in that sense. And then you've got the anti-gravity technology at Carousel, where people who go to Carousel are lifted into the air with an anti-gravity kind of thing. And that's not used for anything except to basically laser 30-year-olds to death. Movies technology doesn't make sense. There's no kind of logic to it. The screenplay is by a guy called David Zille Goodman, who did a number of other things, some better than Logan's Run, some worse. He did the screenplay, for instance, for Straw Dogs and a Foreign Legion movie called March or Die, which had Gene Hackman amongst other people in it. He started out doing TV. He did an episode of Naked City. He did a few episodes of The Untouchable, Mr. Broadway, and Combat. He did the screenplay for Monty Walsh, a very good Lee Marvin movie. Logan's Run, The Eyes of Laura Mars, which had Faye Dunaway in it, and a few other things. So he's kind of like a jobbing screenwriter, but I don't think he had any particular gift for science fiction. In fact, as far as I can see, this is pretty much the only science fiction movie that he did a script for, so he obviously didn't know the tropes and the discipline and the demands of a science fiction movie where you've got to make an internally consistent world. Just didn't happen in this film. The technology is all over the place. It's all kind of visually pretty and visually wow, but it just doesn't make any sense if you think about it. Now, the movie also has a bit of nudity in it, not kind of lingering nudity, but there are nude people in the film. There's a scene where Jenny Agata gets naked after falling into, escaping via some water, and she's cold as they reach an ice cave where Box lives. So there's a bit of nudity in there. There's also a kind of orgy sequence in a nightclub, which bears somewhat of a resemblance to Plato's Retreat, or one of those ones, just to show the hedonism of the city, of course. So basically they've got sex, drugs, and they don't have any rock and roll, but there's a lot of sex and drugs in the city. Everybody's young and beautiful. If you're not as young and beautiful as you want to be, you can go to a new me salon and have a doctor sculpt you the way you want to be physically, from, you know, face or body, and or both. And we do see a sequence with Michael Anderson Jr., the director's son. Michael Anderson was the director of the film, where they Logan goes to, as a part of his investigation into the runners, goes to one of these studios where they basically laser sculpt your face and body to be perfect in the way you want it. And the assistant in that particular salon is none other than Farrah Fawcett Majors, who at the time was married to Lee Majors and had just started her successful career as one of Charlie's Angels. So she's in there, very undistinguished. I mean, Farrah Fawcett was never a particularly gifted actor. She was very attractive and good-looking, had the kind of archetypal female starlet look of the 1970s with the flip-back hair and the, you know, straight teeth and the blue eyes and the cute body and all the rest of it. So she had all of that going for her. But obviously the lady had some personal problems, which ultimately led her to become something of a joke before she unfortunately died of cancer a number of years ago. But, I mean, she's in it as well, and that makes it a very kind of 1970s movie. A lot of the film was filmed in what they call the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, which means basically the movie has a shopping mall future. The city itself looks like a 1970s shopping mall. It's got that kind of bare, austere, brutalist architecture kind of look about it, which has dated horribly. You look at the city in Logan's Run, you automatically think, oh, look, they're using a shopping mall. It's got that kind of, you know, galleries around a central open space look of a shopping mall about it, which, you know, obviously they would have had to, they needed some large spaces to give the sense of the city. And so they used a market in Dallas as that, but nonetheless it does give it a kind of slightly weird look about it. And there's another scene where Francis is sitting in a hot tub near a gymnasium, and it looks like a scene out of You Can't Stop the Music. This movie is so 1970s in a number of ways. It predates AIDS, it predates that backlash and the kind of neo-puritanism we have now. People were polygamous in this future that was posited in the movie. They nobody had religion. It was kind of and the movie doesn't actually make a moral judgment about that one way or the other, apart from the fact that people get killed when they're 30. It's kind of almost neutral about that, which is a fair enough thing too. I think it was made basically by a big studio as an entertainment and without regard to thinking through the premise of it as a science fiction movie, which is a bit of a shame. But of course, this was the 1970s. We didn't have that constant conversation going on about every movie that comes out between thousands of film buffs all across the world, just talking about film, as indeed I am now, of course, you know, I'm a part of it. But there wasn't that kind of culture of film discussion at the time, which enabled us to kind of feed back, in a sense, that you know, this movie didn't do things right, and the studios, the only way that they communicated effectively in a two-way method with their audience was through the box office. So if the movie, if a lot of bums went on seats, the movie was successful. There was no kind of large scale mechanism for offering feedback about films the way IMDb does now, for instance. And there wasn't, therefore, that ability for movie makers to learn what works and what doesn't in a very nuanced way. The only way they knew what worked and what didn't was box office and the opinions of professional critics. And I think that we live in a very different culture now as far as movie appreciation is concerned, where Amateurs are also a voice in offering feedback to studios, but with a movie like Logan's Run, which is basically a bit of froth, and it was successful at the time, but it's kind of, yeah, it's got the shape of a science fiction movie, but in a sense, it could almost be a Western as well. It's got people tracking down desperados. It's no more complex than that, really. Now, the bits that I like about the film are, first off, I like the polygamous nature of the movie. I like the fact that it's non-judgmental about casual and recreational sex. I think this is a very sex-positive message to send, as one of which I approve. So I like that. I also like the character actors in the movie. And Roscoe Lee Brown, even though he's covered in tinfoil playing the robot Box, gets to play larger than life. As soon as Box comes on the thing, rolling down a ramp with the big kind of, you know, mirror-faceted bodywork of the robot, and that beautiful, rich voice that Roscoe Lee Brown had as an actor coming out through what looks like a tinfoil mask really lifts the film. The main characters are fairly bland, really. And I'll talk a little more about why I don't like Logan as a character in a moment, but Roscoe Lee Brown's really great as Box, and he's in one scene there, and kind of we learn the limitations of his programming and the horrors of his programming, because he's a robot who's designed to furnish the city with protein from the seas, and when the seas stop producing protein, he moves on to other means. But I like him in that. I also like Peter Ustinov playing the old man. He does it very well. He's got a kind of thick American accent, even though Ustinov himself was born in London, but he had a really unusual family background. He was Russian, Polish, Jew, German, and Ethiopian descent, even though he was born in London. His uncle was a Russian nobleman. His grandmother was Magdalena Hall, a mixed Ethiopian, German, Jewish origin. So basically, he's a United Nations in one person, and had that look about him as well. He was very big in theatre. He wrote plays, he directed plays, he starred in plays, he did television, he did a number of films. He was one best supporting actor, of course, in Spartacus, and in 1961, and in 1965, one best supporting actor in Top Coffee as well. He was nominated for his screenplay Billy Budd for a BAFTA award. Basically, the guy was a polymath when it came to the arts. And in this one, he does a very sly and a very interesting role. The old man he plays, and the character is called Old Man because he doesn't remember his name, which, you know, is fair enough because he's been living alone with cats for any number of years since his parents died. And Ustinov's playing of the character, even though it's written kind of whimsically, has a combination of wonder and tragedy about it, which kind of lifts the film as well. He's prone to quoting T.S. Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats well before Andrew Lloyd Webber ruined it for everybody by making that stupid fucking banal musical of it. The character is really kind of sweet and touching and childlike in a way. He isn't used to interactions with other human beings, and he hasn't been touched by another person in a number of years. And when Jessica asks to touch his face so she can feel the lines on his face, Ustinov's reaction is perfect for that character. It really is a nice piece of acting in a role that didn't necessarily require the nuance that Ustinov gives to it, and that's very kind of cool. I like actors who, when they're given a job, and it's, you know, not particularly a job that requires their A game, when they actually give their A game and they think through the character, it does lift a film like this, which is kind of can be seen as kind of a bland 1970s science fiction movie in a lot of ways, even though myself at the time and a lot of other young people, men and women, found Jenny Agutter very attractive at the time. In fact, I still do. In spite of that, Ustinov is the kind of heart of the film in some ways. which is kind of cool. Now, Michael York, a good actor in some ways. He's got a great voice for certain kinds of roles. But again, this movie isn't well thought out because both Jenny Agutter and Michael York have English accents. And they're playing characters who are trapped in a domed city in America in the 23rd century. And they're the only people in the entire city who speak with the accent they do. It's kind of a weird thing there. But Michael York and Jenny Agutter, yeah, they're kind of bland in the roles. And Jenny Agutter does give it her best shot, even though her role is crazily underwritten. But nonetheless, I don't like Michael York's Logan because, I'll tell you why, right at the start they make a mistake with this character in the film. Because we're supposed to believe that he's a Sandman whose job it is to kill people who turn 30. And there's a scene at the start where he and Francis, the other Sandman, played by Richard Jordan, track down and hunt down a runner through the city. And here's the problem I've got with him. Both of them take a sadistic glee in teasing, torturing, and then killing this man. And as the movie progresses, we're supposed to see Logan in a different light because suddenly he's a runner and he's the one being chased by Francis and he's the one escaping the city. But the character we see at the start of the film gets off on killing people. It's not just a job. It's not one of those things he has a repugnance for. He gleefully helps Francis torture and kill a man. And that is something I can't really reconcile with the characterization as the film continues. There's no moment when the killer transitions into being a person that we can identify with and respect. And that's the big problem I have with the film in a lot of ways, apart from all those inconsistencies in the technologies and the kind of, you know, would this city work in any meaningful way in a real-world context? That initial meeting we have with Logan shows us a killer and a sadistic killer as well. So that's a big mistake in the script of this film. But the movie did go on to have a short-lived television series based on it with Gregory Harrison and Heather Menzies in it, which was no better or no worse than a number of other science fiction TV series of the 1970s. But Logan's Run, I picked up a copy on Blu-ray quite cheaply, and I thought, oh, I'll re-watch this one and see how it goes for the podcast. And yeah, there are things about it I like. In fact, they've been trying to remake this film for the last 15 or 20 years unsuccessfully. At one stage, Ryan Gosling was attached to it, a number of other people. They're now talking about doing Logan's Run with the Logan character being played by a female, which at least shows they're trying to think outside of the box on it. But I'm not sure the film's worthy of being remade in that sense. I don't know whether there's enough there for it to kind of work well in a 21st century context, the same way that remake of Total Recall didn't work. I think you've got to let certain genre films be of their time and kind of accept them as kind of time capsules of that time. Even though they're set in the future, they very much speak to the time they were made in, the 1970s in this case. And remaking it, I'm not sure there's much you can add to it that that the original movie didn't do or that we really needed to know. But anyway, I'm going to wrap it up with Logan's Run. So revisit it if you haven't seen it for a long time. If you haven't seen it at all, definitely watch it. But just be aware of the fact that seeing it here deep in the second decade of the 21st century, it's a very different experience than I had when I saw it in the cinema when it came out. It's I'm a different person in a lot of ways, and I think the world's a very different place, and that works in favour of some films, but in this case, I think it definitely doesn't work in the favour of Logan's Run. But anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you to all the Patreon subscribers. Thank you to the people who send lovely things on Facebook, letting me know that they like the podcast. Always appreciate that feedback. And anyway, take care of yourselves. Look after each other. Look after yourself. Watch good movies. Watch bad movies. Eat good food. Drink good coffee. Never drink bad coffee. It's not worth the fucking hassle. And I'll be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast and next fortnight with another Martian Drive-In podcast. In the meantime, as usual, here are the credits to the podcast, done in the style of movie credits. Now, I do have an extra credit to do, but unfortunately, I haven't had time to do that credit, so I will definitely be adding that next time around. In the meantime, here are the credits, and thank you again for your attention. And now, here are the podcast credits. I'd like to thank Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tamora, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Solomon, our werewolf consultant, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H., our set photographer, and the two extras, Mark D. and David L. Thank you to all of the podcast supporters.